Good evening and welcome to this CIFL seminar. It is my pleasure to introduce to you tonight Yinhuan Lee from the University of Bristol. Yinhuan is now a stranger to Cambridge. She got her PhD over here, but she left us to go to Sheffield, and now she is a senior lecturer at the University of Bristol. Last year, for one of our CIFL events, we had Jonathan Griffiths over, who talked about the definition of a work in copyright. And Jonathan made reference to Yinhuan's older now work, two articles that were published on the persistence of the text in the definition of the concept of a work in copyright. And that's what gave us the idea of inviting Yinhuan back to talk to us about issues relevant to the definition of a work. And I think, Yinhuan, you're also going to be talking about other research just relatively. So thank you very much for coming. Look forward to the talk.
Thank you very much, Christina. Yes, when I heard that Jonathan had done that, I slightly freaked out and wondered, well, what is he going to say? But I guess we'll find out. So thank you very much for inviting me. It's always great to be back at Cambridge. And after tackling work, I decided to tackle copy. So being ambitious here. I think I presented this in an embryonic form in 2018 here. So I hope it is now slightly more developed. Otherwise, I would have spent the last too many years to think about doing not very much. To contextualize this a bit, I guess, and link it back to the work I've done on the work, I think when I was writing the piece about the persistence of the text, it was partly at the end of the day about how it is. Copyright now protects something more than the text, but it's very hard to articulate how much more and where you draw the line around what you want to protect that's something other than the text. And in this one, I think the idea is similar in the sense that the idea is to look at how copying historically was used kind of as a tool to restrict the right holder's entitlement in certain ways, and say, even though this act is technically copying in the sense that it produces a duplicate because of the form in which the duplicate is in, we do not consider this copying and therefore takes it outside the scope of the right holder's entitlement. And of course, the conclusion at the end of the day is that although we have some sense, there's some sense that we want the right holder's entitlement to be limited in a certain way. And we reached for concepts like reasonable commercial exploitation or the right holder's market. These are kind of quite slippery terms that don't also give us a very clear idea of what it is that we think the scope of the right holder's entitlement ought to be. So I think this. I hope this will become clearer as I go through the actual talk. So the exclusive right to prevent copying or reproduction of a work is the most fundamental and historically the oldest right of a copyright owner. This is what Coppinger and Scone James have told us for several editions now. And over the last 20 years or so, there have been spikes of academic interest in interrogating the scope of the right to copy, beginning, I think, in the US, and most recently, there has been a lot of interest in Europe. There's an edited collection called Copyright Reconstructed, Rethinking Copyright's Economic Rights in a Time of Highly Dynamic Technological and Economic Change, published in 2018, a project led by scholars at the University of Amsterdam that has helped me a lot with my thinking around this topic. So, the general consensus, which will not be surprising to anyone, is that the right to copy or the right of reproduction has basically gone too far, because it now, as we all know, covers things like when you browse the internet. That's a copy for the purposes of copyright law. Under the this is a worldwide trend, but specifically in the UK, under the CDPA, the right to copy now extends to the reproduction of protected works in any material form and includes even the making of copies, which are transient or incidental to some other use of the work. The broad scope of this right is ameliorated to some extent by defenses, or in more European language, exceptions and limitations. But these tend to be framed narrowly, whereas the right is framed very broadly. And so certain uses that we might think ought not to be caught by the right remain caught. Lady Prescott and Vittoria argue, perhaps only slightly facetiously, that you might infringe copyright if you read newspaper over to someone's shoulder on the train. Because section 178 of the CDPA defines electronic as including actuated by electromagnetic or electrochemical energy. Light is a form of electromagnetic energy. An image of the page is formed on your retina as you read the passage in the paper. The states of the cells, they explain, are actuated by this electromagnetic energy. The array of cones stores a sharp image of the newspaper page. True, the image is transient, but the access that transient copies count. And next, by a series of steps, the neurons in the person's brain are caused to fire in a certain way. He will experience the conscious sensation of viewing the page. But the point is that the relevant biomechanical processes are actuated by electrochemical energy. He's now storing the work in his brain, if he can remember it anyway, by electronic means. All this reasoning is uncontroversial in scientific terms, but totally absurd all the same. Is it, though? Is there anything in the act that stops this from being an actionable act of, that stops this from being copying as defined in the statute? I mean, it's very disturbing, right? This whole notion that something, just by reading, by doing unauthorized reading, you might be infringing copyright, but that potentially is an interpretation of the statute. You might try to get around it with a temporary copying exception and go like, this enables a lawful use, but is it, that raises the question, is it a lawful use to read somebody else's newspaper when you haven't paid for the newspaper?
Yes. I mean, don't we know that the brain operates through chemical processes, not just electric processes, actually? So I don't know. I mean, I don't know. That it seems to me that it's an overstretch.
Yeah, but you see, if we need to come down to, does the brain operate electronically or chemically? That seems, we shouldn't even, but the point is that probably we shouldn't even be coming close to asking this question. We should probably want to say, yes, it's not problematic at all to read somebody's newspaper over their shoulder. I think having to put it in technical, chemical versus electrical terms is sort of conceding a lot of the argument. I mean, I don't think we should be really making these, I don't see why we are in a place where we have to make these fine technical distinctions. This just seems to be quite ridiculous. But anyway, thanks for the question, David. So in the literature, concerns articulated by commentators around the broad scope of copying, they seem to coalesce as far as I can tell, around two major concerns. So the first is that this particular scenario, that it allows essentially the right holder to control the reception or enjoyment of a protected work by an individual to read it, to view it, etc. And the second concern is aimed at something, it's a bit technical, but I would describe it as that it allows the second concern is that this broad definition of copying allows the right holder to control activities, control acts of copying that are aimed at something other than the communication of the expressive content of the protected work.
Aren't you just using copying and reproduction synonymously, though? Those are two different things.
Yes, these are potentially two different things, which is why this has been very hard to write, actually, because of the way the terms are working. So I will use copying when I'm using the words of the statute, because that's what the statute means. I agree you can have a potentially, the statute uses copying. The European legislation uses reproduction, which causes also issues. I'm going to use copying when I mean something, copying that is legally significant for the purposes of the Copyright Act, for the Copyright Statute, and then use reproduction for the factual or technical description of this is very hard to say, creating a second, creating a duplicate. This is, has been quite tricky because of the different words that I have to use. So in the literature, these have been referred variously to as non-expressive uses, non-display uses, non-communicative uses, and non-consumptive uses. These uses are said to include digitization, indexing, computer analysis, computational analysis, and archiving of works to enable searching, to enable copyright infringement detection, text and data mining. So the idea is that when you, for instance, engage in text and data mining on the work, you are not using the work for its expressive purposes. You are deriving, extracting the informational contents of the works. And these are sort of just put under the heading of these are non-expressive uses, and therefore the right holder should have no control over them, because copyright is about protecting the expression of the work. So the proposals for dealing with the broad scope of copyright in light of these concerns, they come into somewhat different flavors. The first one is the suggestion that you carve out certain kinds of reproduction from the scope of copying. So this would be, you create a duplicate, but that has no meaning for the purposes of copyright. It's not potentially infringing at all. This has been expressed as examples of these kind of proposals. Limiting infringements to copies that allow the work to be used as a work, or reproductions that are done for non-expressive purposes. And then kind of more broadly sweeping kind of proposal is simply to eliminate the right to copy and replace it with a broad right of commercial exploitation. So instead of looking at has copying happened, you ask, does this interfere with the right holder's right of commercial exploitation? So I'm going to try to make two arguments. So these concerns that, first, that a very broad definition of copying hinders personal private uses, and second, that a very broad definition of copying allows a right holder to capture uses that in some sense the law might not want to consider something that the right holder can legitimately be entitled to. And I would like to suggest that this is not entirely new, even though we associate them with digital technology very strongly. I'm going to suggest that courts in the 19th century were already doing a rudimentary form of this. So in cases of reproduction that involve a change in medium, so a photograph of a painting, for instance, the courts will be confronted with the question of, is this copying in the legal sense? And suggest that instead of simply asking, well, has there technically been a reproduction? Is there, you know, has this duplicated the work in front of you? They would try to define, to approach the question in ways such as to exclude activities that they did not think the right holder ought legitimately to be able to profit from or to control. And the second related argument is that I would like to suggest that contemporary scholars arguing for a curtailment or reconceptualization of the right to copy might be encountering the same conceptual hurdles that 19th century judges themselves faced and were not able to surmount. And that is to articulate a set of principles for drawing the line between activities that the right holder ought to be able to control, or in a normative sense, and activities that the right holder ought not to be able to control. And this shows that it's a long-standing problem. And as we find our way past that, it's going to be very difficult. So what I'm going to do is look at some cases and then suggest that ideas around something is copying only it's an activity that affects the commercial value of the work is something that has been sort of bubbling around even in the 19th century. And secondarily, that there was also, perhaps less obviously, but arguably present, a concern around would a broad definition of copying prevent activities taking place in private, by private individuals. Very tritely, we start with the Statue of Anne and some very obvious observations about it. The Statue of Anne does not, of course, use the language of copying, but it uses the language of printing and reprinting. And obviously, this was not done consciously to use the language, or simply this was the activity, I think, sought to be regulated. But the language of printing and reprinting has a number of points about it. The first I would suggest is that it delineates the scope of the right holder's entitlements relatively clearly. This is not just based on the language, but also on the technological levels and also the customs and practices of the guilds that were prevalent at the time. So at the time, only commercial printers and publishers would have access to a printing press. And this effectively meant that if you give the right holder the right to print and reprint copies, that effectively, I suggest, confines the scope of the right holder's entitlement to control copies made in the same way at about the same scale, the commercial scale, by other commercial actors working within the same industry. And this had the bonus of excluding, for instance, handwritten copies, which is the only form of technology that most private individuals would have access to at the time, the main form of copying technology that the private individuals would have access to at the time. It also excludes other modes of commercial exploitation. This is, for instance, it would, for instance, in Thomson and Collins, Blackstone arguing in favor of copyright common law, says is quite happy to say that this statute does not prevent somebody from buying a book and then lending it out as part of a circulating library for a fee. So obviously he had reasons for saying this because there were reasons at the time rhetorically to argue for to persuade people that copyright is quite a limited right. It's not going to have hideous far-reaching consequences of what you can do. But this was a suggestion that was made. As more and more different types of creations were brought into the copyright fold, the language had to expand. This happened a lot with artistic works, because there are different ways of making an artistic work. So in the Engraver's Copyright Act, you see the language of, for instance, a list of specific methods of creating an engraving, and then at the end of it, otherwise or in any other manner, copy. And then if you skip to the bottom of it, the Fine Arts Copyright Act says the exclusive right of copying, engraving, reproducing, and multiplying. And then, so you can see the language becoming less about specific technology at a specific scale and more about, becoming more abstract. And this also even happens in the 1842 Act, Copyright Act of 1842, which is the one of the successor statutes to the Statute of Anne, where copyright is defined as meaning not just printing, but also otherwise multiplying copies. So that's where the language of copying sort of starts coming in. So part of my argument is that when the question of whether something is a copy then becomes relevant and something that is litigated. And one of the points I would like to suggest is that when the courts were faced with cases of reproduction that involve a change of medium or form, they were not confining themselves to a sort of dictionary or literal definition of copying. They were looking to see whether it was a mode of copying which they thought the right holder ought legitimately to be able to control. And I don't necessarily know if this was very express in the minds of the judges, but I would like to suggest that, you know, there was something more going on than the court simply going, has a second duplication of this being produced, then it is copying and you are liable. They were doing something a bit more involved than that. See, chronologically, we look at Gambart and Ball. Gambart was one of the Victorian era's most prominent art dealers. He had such a fascinating life. He also made a lot of money. He made obscene amounts of money. I hope I'll have a chance later to tell you how obscene the amounts were. Mm-hmm. So he had the copyright. So he would his modus operandi is that he would buy paintings. He bought a lot of paintings from living English artists. That was a time when English art was very popular. And among them, my favorite guy is the Pre-Raphaelites. So these were the he would then have them engraved, and then he would sell copies of the engravings to the public. This was one of the many ways in which he profited from these paintings. So on the left is engraving of William Holman Hunt's Light of the World. And on the right is Rosa Bonheur's The Horse Fair. Rosa Bonheur specialized in pictures of farm animals. Well, animals. They were also very large. The defendant had copied them on a very reduced scale by means of photography. So had taken photographs of the engravings and then sold them. And the question is whether if you do that, if you take a photograph of an engraving, that is copying within the meaning of the statute. And so what the court did was not simply to say, well, there's a causal relation between the photograph and the engraving. The photograph duplicates the engraving and therefore it's a copy. They went into some detail as to the impact of the commercial value, or the impact of the photograph on the commercial value of the painting. Sorry, of the engraving. I keep saying painting. It's actually an engraving, obviously. Chief Justice Earle said the object of the statute is to secure the commercial value of the property. It is plain that a photographic copy may excite in the mind of the beholder the same pleasurable emotions as would be communicated by a copy of any other description. And I see no reason why these very wide and general words should not be construed according to their plain and ordinary meaning and be held to apply to any mode of copying known at that time and to such other modes of multiplying copies as the ingenuity of man may from time to time discover. In the representation of the horse fair, we feel the same degree of pleasure in looking at the forms and attitudes of the beautiful animals portrayed. Whether we see them, this is quite striking, whether we see them in the size in which they are drawn in the original picture. So these pictures by Rosa Bonheur, they're very, very large. I can't remember the exact figures, but they are sometimes larger than a person. They're larger than a person. So the engraving was a reduced size. But Chief Justice Earle says, does it make a difference? We feel the same degree of pleasure whether we are looking at them in the original large size or the reduced size of the engraving or in the still more diminished form in which they appear in the photograph. The value of the plaintiff's property would be sensibly diminished if the multiplication of copies by means of photography were held to be lawful. So the making of these photographic copies of the engravings was held to be copying and therefore infringement. What's also interesting is that Mr. Justice Wills excluded copies made by hand and said we limit this specifically to copying carried out through, we limit this to reproduction through mechanical processes that have the potential to produce an infinite number of copies. So there's some regard to the commercial nature of the activity, some reference to the idea that having the photographic copies in circulation reduces the value of the plaintiff's engravings, presumably because people would then buy the cheaper photographs instead of the more expensive engravings. We don't have a case that annoys me extremely because I cannot find the originals of the works discussed in the case. So Dixon Brooks is also an engravings case. It is an engraving by Barlow of of the picture on the left, which is Millet's The Huguenot. It was published in the Christmas number of this periodical, The Bow Bells, which is described as a magazine of general literature and art for family reading. It was published not like this, but it was adapted into a pattern for Berlin woolwork, which is basically cross stitch. So you had it was done in little colors. There was a version of it. You can imagine an overlay of it in little colored squares that tell people which what color threads to use in which squares. It annoys me. So it would have this. This is a very generic pattern of Berlin woolwork. Oh, this is a very generic Berlin woolwork pattern. It gives you some idea what it might look like. It annoys me that I cannot find the actual issue of the Bow Bells that has the actual pattern referred to in the action here. I can't even find out whether it's a regular issue, whether it's a special issue, because extra issue, because it's a Christmas issue. So the court here reached the opposite conclusion from Gambart and Ball and said the Berlin woolwork pattern of this engraving of the Huguenot is not a copy of the engraving. Lord Justice James said, no one would ever take it to be the print. No one would ever buy it instead of a print. It is a work of a different class intended for a different purpose. Lord Justice Bramwell says, what the legislature had in view was a new engraving or something which could be taken as an engraving or an equivalent to it. There is also some, I would suggest, some reference to things being to private activities. Lord Justice Bagley says, the word copy must receive some limitation, for it cannot have been intended to apply to a lady copying a print or part of a print on a china plate, or to a person who, for his own amusement, makes an etching, drawing, or watercolor sketch from an engraving. Okay. And then we have Abuzi and White, which is a case about music, and this case revolved around the Aeolian organ, which is an automated piano player. These are the sheets that have the music on them. You feed this sheet with the holes or perforations in it into the Aeolian organ, and then it plays the music. Spotify for the Victorian age. At the time, the other popular mode of selling copies of music was selling sheets of music. So there was a question as to whether this perforated sheet was a copy of the sheet music, and the court said it was not. Lord Justice Romer said the legislature never contemplated that the author's right to multiply copies of published music would entitle him to stop the use in private of such an instrument because it performed the published music. He also says the plaintiff's sheets and the defendant's sheets, so sheet music and these perforated sheets, are issued and used for substantially different objects. Music sheets are issued and used as books to be read. Perforated sheets are not used as books to be read, but as parts of a mechanical musical instrument to produce the sounds of music. This is a thing. And then I need to tell you about something called tableau. My French is bad. Tableau vivant. So, because they didn't have Netflix, the Victorians enjoyed. Well, if you were an affluent Victorian, well, your entertainments would be to dress, get a group of friends together, dress yourselves up as the subjects of famous paintings, and then arrange yourselves in the poses of the figures in the famous paintings. So there's a reason I put Botticelli's Primavera up here. You see on the left, a socialite of the time, Mrs. Hazel Lavery. She is basically dressed and posing as the goddess Flora from Primavera. So this took place as a private entertainment in the homes of, the Victorian middle and upper classes. There is a description of one such in Vanity Fair by Thackeray. There's also a kind of description in Gone with the Wind, but let's not talk about Gone with the Wind. But it was also a popular stage entertainment. And these were very pretty massive spectacles. You would get actresses, models dressed up and pose in the figures of pose in the same way as the figures of famous paintings. Classical paintings were popular because, not to be mean to the Victorians, classical paintings were popular because normally in a classical painting, a Greek classical inspired painting, the women are not dressed in very many layers of clothing. So this was attractive to viewers, I'm sure. My colleague Catherine Kelly also suggests, somewhat, maybe not entirely facetiously, that when these entertainments happened in the home, it was also a cultured, less obvious way for the young women to display to the unmarried young men their other assets other than their dowries and fortunes. And in that way, she suggests it may have helped the marriage market. I couldn't find anything about this specifically. So one of the theaters known for putting on these tableaux vivants was the Empire Palace Theater, which you can see on the left. And unfortunately, at this point, I cannot find the actual documents from the case. But this gives you an idea. That's the building. Here's one of the playbills for one particular evening. And you will see that living pictures are very heavily advertised. So what happened in the Empire Palace case in 1894? It's a slightly complicated case because parts of it are about sketches. But never mind that. So the interesting part of the case is that copyright owner brought an action against the theater, basically for staging a tableau vivant based on the painting, I think, in which they held the copyright. And there was a question as to whether if you stage a tableau vivant, whether that is a copy of the painting or not. The court said it was not. This was because Parliament was not, and this was because, said Lord Justice Linley, this is to Parliament is not dealing with or intending to limit the scope of a sculptor's business or an actor's business. It is to protect painters and persons who produce drawings and photographs from having the commercial value of their productions impaired by the reproduction of something. By something of a character similar to that of which they were the authors. So the statutory language intends to protect the author of the picture from anybody's producing a painting, drawing, or photograph of his picture so as to compete with him in the market. So again, this notion that, you know, you cannot control anything that might plausibly be described as a reproduction. You can only compare copies that impact on the commercial value of your work in some way. And he says, the statutory language appears to me to be incapable of being stretched so as to touch such a representation as is sought to be restrained in this case. And also concludes by saying, if it did, it would follow that anyone who arranges in his own private drawing room a tableau vivant of his friends or guests for the purposes of imitating a group of figures in a well-known picture would be infringing the Copyright Act. So again, a concern with the commercial, you know, does this impact commercial value? But also a secondary concern with, does this stop people doing things that fund things in private, basically? So that's why there's the first part of the argument, which suggests that these are sort of the idea that we need to... we need to stop copying from reaching, the definition of copying from being so broad as to reach into what people do in their personal lives and also to reach into activities that we think are not something that the right holder ought legitimately to be able to control. That, I would suggest, is something that is sort of subtext, well, maybe not overtly, very obviously always there, but can be found, some indication of this can be found even in the 19th century case law. And then I hit the second part of my argument, which is that So my argument here is that although the courts were trying to say the right holder's entitlement should only go so far, the problem is that they have not really articulated principles for telling us, oh, how far do they go? How far ought they to go? How do we distinguish between an act of reproduction or use, which ought legitimately to fall into the right holder's control, and uses that ought legitimately to fall outside it? In the contemporary period, this has become, I think, quite pressing for copying related to tax and data mining, for instance. So as I look back at what the courts said in these cases, a striking thing is that the courts seem quite confident about their conclusions. They would say, I mean, the tone is, of course, Parliament cannot have intended to stop people staging living pictures on stage. Of course, perforated music sheets do not perform the same function as sheet music. Of course, a photograph of an engraving impacts on the market for the engraving. But a rendering of an engraving for a Berlin woodwork pattern does not. Of course, it doesn't. It's very hard to identify any sort of common thread in terms of why. So why do we say, of course, these are not copies because they're too far removed? But of course, these are copies because they're not too far removed. I would also like to suggest that if you look back at the case law, you can make the argument plausibly the other way. So if you look at Gambart and Ball, which is about photographic reproductions of engravings, it is less cut and dried, arguably, than the court seems to be suggesting. At around the time of the decision, there was a huge debate about whether people should be allowed to buy and sell these photographic reproductions. One argument frequently raised is that the photographs are sold at very different price points from the actual engravings. The engravings are much more expensive. They're the luxe product. The photographs are significantly cheaper. Now, of course, you expect the photography press to support this argument because of their industrial interests. But interestingly, the Art Journal, which is one of the most prominent 19th century art magazines, made this in point and said it's absurd to argue, as some do, that such a result, namely a loss to the right holder in the engraving, follows the sale of a shilling photograph of a print for which 2 or 3 guineas must be paid. So the price points are very different. The purchaser of the latter is generally a man who can afford to pay more or less expensively for the indulgence of his taste, and in all probability requires the print to ornament his home. The buyer of the former purchases because the photograph pleases him simply on account of the subject and its price suits his purse. In neither case is it likely that the thing bought would be reversed. The rich man is indifferent to the photograph, or he is in possession or can possess himself if he so pleases of the more costly and covetable work, which the poorer man cannot do even when he disposed. His investment of 1 or 2 shillings in the miniature edition of a fine print is clearly no detriment to the producer of the latter. So you could see, in a slightly different turn of events, the court going, taking into account these economic facts, we find that the photographic versions are not copies because they do not compete in the same market. They're negligible impact on the commercial value. I'm not saying necessarily this is empirically a fact, but it is a narrative that was around at that time, and you know, not a narrative that you can easily dismiss. The middle class or upper middle class man buying an engraving because it looks nice in his house and he wants to impress his guests is not going to buy a cheap photograph of the same engraving for this purpose. The same applies also to the music sheets and the perforated sheets. The court in Boosie and White said that they do not serve the same functions. But if we take a step back, maybe they do. So in the 19th century, if you wanted to have music was a popular form of entertainment, both at home and on stage. If you wanted to have music in the home, you did not have Spotify. Somebody had to play it. If you were a man, it was your daughter or your wife who had been hopefully given expensive training to help them achieve this, and also to make them more attractive prospects in the marriage market. It was not for so it was not taught very masculine for men to be, you know, overly interested in these things. So you can imagine a narrative which was actually later developed in post Boozy, very shortly after Boozy and White and Sell, the evidence that was submitted around the discussions leading up to the 1911 Copyright Act. You can imagine the narrative, which is that once you have these automated piano players, that is what you get when you want music in the home. You no longer have your expensively trained wife or daughter or sister no longer has to go out, buy the latest music sheet, learn it, and then play it for everybody's entertainment at home. You could just get this machine, buy the perforated sheets, and off you go. And so there's conflicting evidence as to empirically whether the perforated sheets started displacing sales of the sheet music. Predictably, the companies making the perforated sheets argued that there was no impact at all on sheet music sales. In fact, people, after hearing the music on via the automated piano player, then get interested in buying the sheet music, actually. The publishers of the music sheets said, this is very bad. We have seen loss of sales, expected sales, due to the incursion of the perforated sheets. Again, it's not, obviously, it's empirically difficult to say exactly what happened, probably a mixture of the two. But that was a narrative also that was available. And sorry, this is, and then I go to a slightly left field argument, which is that even when you think back on, for instance, these living pictures, I think it seems to the 20th century, to the 21st century mind, of course, you know, showing the pictures on the stage with performers doesn't have any impact on the potential commercial value or sales of the picture. But in the Victorian period, one way of making quite a lot of money from owning a painting was to hang it in the gallery somewhere and then charge the public money to come and look at it. People actually did pay for this. Again, they didn't have Netflix, so this was a popular form of entertainment. When Gambart, the art dealer from Gambart and Ball, he bought another painting from William Holman Hunt, I think for 5,000 guineas, which was a very large amount of money. He hung the picture up in a gallery and charged the public a shilling each look at. He made back the full price of the painting in a year. This is not accounting. This is how marriage makes so much money. It's not accounting for his other sources of income from the picture. So arguably, the idea that showing people a painting as a way of making money from the painting is not as alien possibly to the Victorian mind as it is now. Again, there's no empirical evidence that paintings being recreated as living pictures in the theatres had any empirical effect on the number of people who are willing to pay money to view the same painting. And in fact, the fact that these performances were time limited probably had something to do with it. But again, you know, it's not, I think it's not sort of so obviously remote. The two modes of exploitation are not so obviously remote and separated from each other that a judge could comfortably say, yeah, these are completely unrelated activities. What's also interesting, of course, is that there was no public display right, and there's still no public display right in the UK for pictures. So basically, we go back to kind of what we started with, which is that copyright has grown. So as I said earlier, that critics of the sort of wide breadth of copyright have proposed, for instance, carving out some things that are technically reproductions from the scroll of the right to copy. So making them not legally significant, or reframing the right to copy so as to become reframing the right to copy and a possibly a number of the other rights into a single right of a reasonable commercial reproduction, reasonable commercial exploitation, for instance. I think, as you know, well-meaning and important efforts, by my sense is that they're coming up against the same barrier, which is how do you draw the line between, well, for instance, what's a reasonable commercial exploitation? Where does that line start and end? If you take a very simple example, let's say, should I be allowed to lend a digital copy of a book to a friend? Now, I would say that involves multiple acts of reproduction, right? Because I send it to them, they download it. Now, I would say that is something that is beyond, that should be beyond the scope of the right holder's entitlement to control. I bought the book, you know, I want to share it with my friend, I should be able to do this. But equally, you have the other narrative saying that, well, if everyone wants to read the book, they can buy the book. I mean, these are the very different ways of looking at the world, where I think if you're a right holder and you're a maximalist, what you want is, you don't want anyone to share anything, basically. You want people to buy their own copy of basically everything. And how, like, I think the point that's difficult for me is, how do you say which one is the, you know, is the right way of looking at it? How do you say that where the reasonable commercial exploitation line is to be drawn? And I think the historical cases show that we do not have a very clear and concrete sense of, you know, what are the kinds of things that go into that kind of analysis, because as I've tried to show, around all of the acts of copying / reproduction that were in discussion in those 19th century cases, you could build a plausible case one way or the other. And it's not clear why, once one approach is chosen, it's not clear why a particular approach is chosen in the particular case. It's not clear what are the sort of factors underpinning that. Maybe there are no underpinning factors. Maybe it's a very vibes, intuition-based approach. But I don't think vibes and intuition are, you know, very consistent principles for building up an approach to what is an important legal and also economic question. I also think, for instance, some of the other formulations that have been tried by contemporary scholars, so saying copying should not include non-expressive reproductions, that sounds nice as an abstract principle when you say, well, copying shouldn't include non-expressive reproductions because copyright is meant to protect expression. But then when you try to apply it, I think, to specific concrete cases, it becomes quite difficult. So, for instance, a lot of scholars from around this, from around that period seem to be pretty, you know, well agreed that text and data mining is definitely a species of non-expressive copying. So reproductions that occur in the course of text and data mining are merely technical reproductions, non-expressive reproductions, and therefore ought not to fall within the scope of copying. But okay, I can accept that in some, for some final uses of text and data mining, such as if you upload a whole corpus of Victorian novels to see how frequently the word engraving occurs. Maybe that's extracting the information. But once you get past that, I think it's very hard to say that there's no expressive uses arising from that sort of activity. Take Google Books, for instance, which, granted, it uploads a lot of books into its system, and it feeds you back. When you search for a book for a reference or a word, it shows you the snippets. But those snippets are expressive content. And if you want to say, no, that's not enough expression, that's a different argument, right? You're not saying there's no conveying of the expression to you. You're saying that there's too little expression. I think that's a different doctrine. That's like a de minimis type doctrine. That's not necessarily to do with the expressiveness of the user otherwise. And now I wonder if people still hold the same view that text and data mining, you know, is a classic example of a non-expressive use. But for instance, the now big thing is with generative AI and how it uses text and data mining. And the purpose of the generative AI is, at the end of the day, to produce expressive content. Or do we need something that looks like expressive content, that takes from the expressive content of its training data? So is that, you know, is that training, is that is the text and data mining that occurs in the process still a non-expressive use if the endpoint is to in some way produce a form of expression that is causally linked in some sense to what is in the training data? So what happens with this observation? Well, I don't know. But I think the point is that the idea that there should be limits to the right holder's entitlement to exploit the protected work is something that shows up very frequently in copyright, not just in the context of the right to copy, but also, say, in public performance, who is the right holder's public for the purposes of public performance, possibly who is the new public for the purposes of the communication to the public, right? It shows up when you're talking about the defenses, when you talk about does the defendant's use have a negative impact on the value of the protected work. This presupposes that there is some sort of stable idea where we think how far the copyright owner's entitlement extends. But I'm not sure we have that. And we keep sort of circling around notions of, since the 19th century, circling around notions of the value, the commercial value of the right holder's work. The market for the right holder's work, has there been a negative impact? We still do it now in contemporary scholarship. We transplant that into words like non-expressive uses, non-consumptive uses. If we discuss, for instance, in the US, when you discuss a fourth fair use factor, you look at, well, what's the, has this got an impact on the market for the copyrighted work? But we're not necessarily going very far in terms of developing a stable understanding of the limits of the right holder's entitlement, or principles that allow us to at some point start delineating the limits. So, as you know, my conclusion to the paper on the precision of the text was that I don't know what to do with this information. And I have the same conclusion now. I don't know what to do with this information. Someone smarter than me can take this forward. And apparently, I got a PhD student from Bournemouth got in touch with me last year to say that she was going to grapple in her PhD with the questions that I raised in the persistence of the text, to which I replied, "I'm very sorry that I did this to you." So yeah, maybe hopefully someone smarter than me will come along and tell me how I ought to be thinking about how do you define where the right holder's market is. Oh, a final point is that who should do this defining of the right holder's entitlement? Is it the right holder by going to specific markets? Are we going to say if the right holder can make plans or invest in a particular form of exploitation, then we will accept that that forms now part of the entitlement? Does this apply individually on a sector-wide basis or across copyright as a whole? If one, for instance, very random example, one filmmaker starts selling t-shirts that have images from the film on them, does that mean that falls into every single right holder's entitlement from now on? Is this something that should be decided by the legislature, for instance? Because it looks on the face of it like a big policy question, and those are normally, judges are normally very comfortable with those and would prefer the legislature to deal with this. But there's a question as to whether the legislature is able or has the political will to do this, especially at this present time. And indeed, if you look at the current iteration of the Copyright Designs and Patents Act, there are sort of weird little exceptions. They are very technology specific. They are now no longer in use, well, no longer really relevant, such as the exception that allows home taping of broadcast television, which is still there, but you know, it's not really in use in the current age. So does legislation have to keep updating itself every time somebody comes to them with here's some technology that could potentially present problems, because that sounds like, you know, it would be every day. And so that if that leaves us with the judges, then they need a set of principles to work from. And at the moment, I don't think that exists. So, yeah, sorry, I rambled too long. Thank you.